was to address you on the topic, the psychopathology of the record collector. Within this juicy subject, we could examine such phenomena as why dealers like to buy from seasoned collectors, knowing that they will find so many records unplayed, even unopened. Or we could study case histories such as that of the rotund, lusty collector from Vienna who liked his food, his women, and everything else in huge quantities, including his favorite records. A man who actually ordered through us 100 copies of the Maria Galvani Queen of the Night aria from Magic Blue and of Selma Kurz's lovely rendition of Der Vogel in Walde, in both cases having the same selection pressed on both sides of the record. Do any of these ever turn up today, I wonder, 45 years later? You see, I too am a clinical case. To me, it is almost, though not as quite as important as hearing the music, to know about a record, its title and number, its history. Hence my passion for information, for collecting catalogs, supplements, and periodicals. And thus it was that I compiled the material for and wrote The Record Collector's Guide exactly 50 years ago. But to go back a bit further, or to set the stage as it were, in 1929 I founded the Concert Bureau of the City College of New York and also started writing for academic newspapers. So, as critic for the same, I attended some 80 Metropolitan Opera performances over a four-year span. Just 2 weeks ago, I discussed these performances and their fabulous casts in a talk before the New York Vocal Record Collector Society. To give you a taste, let me read you just a few. Tito Ruffo as Tonio and Pagliacci. Shalyapin as Mephistopheles and Faust. Louise Homer as Azucena and Trovatore, her farewell performance. Galli Curci as Rosina and the Barber of Seville, her farewell performance. Matsunawa as Amneris and Aida, her farewell performance. And Gioconda with Poncel and Lori Volpi, Traviata, Bori, Gili, De Luca, Manon, also Bori, Gili, De Luca, Forza del Destino, Poncel and Martinelli, Africana, Poncel, Gili, Romeo, again Bori, Gili, De Luca, Meistersinger, Maria Miller and Shaw, Mignon, Bori and Gili, Norma, Poncel and Telva, La Juive, Rethberg and Martinelli, Madame Butterfly, again Rethberg and Martinelli, Pelias, Bori and Johnson, Siegfried, Melchior and Shaw. All this within 2 years, between January 21st, 1929 and March 6, 1931. I illustrated the discussion, of course, by playing the outstanding recordings of these artists. During the early 1930s, I had intended to become a concert manager as well. I made a promising start with a series I directed at the Great Hall of City College. The Great Hall is a large, domed, and very impressive auditorium. It was the hall in which the New York Philharmonic played its summer concerts when they were rained out of Lewisohn Stadium. Now let me say something about these six concerts I managed. The cost of tickets, by the way, was $1 for the entire series. First, on November 18th, 1933, was the Musical Art Quartet with Sasha Jacobson, its first violinist and creator of many fine Columbia recordings. The next week, Beniamino Riccio, an excellent baritone, whom I also personally managed. In fact, in subsequent concerts at Town and Carnegie Halls and a performance of Rigoletto. Riccio was a fine performer, but an absolute nut. And I could never become the obsequious solicitor of Park Avenue dowagers as seemed necessary for financial backing. Obsequious solicitor? I'm sure there's a more down-to-earth way of expressing that, but I won't say it here. And then, on December 2nd, 1933, the great Joseph Levine appeared. I had arranged that concert through Rosina Levine and had engaged as well the duo pianists Vera Brodsky and Harold Triggs, who were her proteges. Joseph Levine himself was superb, gave a long, thrilling performance, and backstage afterwards was sweating as I have never seen an individual sweat. Incidentally, the fee he charged me for that whole performance was $150. And I, in turn, sold individual tickets for 50 cents apiece. Of course, that was 1933. At this time, Peter Urey, not yet. But these Depression years were unrewarding for this would-be impresario. Besides which, delving into catalogs and supplements was consuming more and more of my time and interest. By 1936, I had completed research on a thorough list of Victor Red Seal and Columbia celebrity recordings made before 1912. With the help of a local printer, I published the book in May of 1936 and was immediately plunged into the record business. You see, slim and physically unimpressive as my record collector's guide looked, it was reviewed by major critics in newspapers and magazines throughout the world, largely, no doubt, because of the people with whom I was dealing, Paderewski, Melba, Rachmaninoff, others. Suddenly, collectors wrote me from everywhere, asking to obtain or to trade favorite recordings. And so, out of this, the American Record Collectors Association was born in 1936. At the same time, Peter U. Reed invited me to write for the American Music Lover, now the American Record Guide. My first column appeared in the July 1936 issue. And in that very month, Mr. Jack Caden, then an itinerant glove salesman who collected records en route, asked me to assist him in setting up a record business. I agreed and promptly took him on a journey to and through Philadelphia, a wonderful source, where I had heard of a mysterious, gloomy warehouse near the waterfront. Sounds like a gangster sitcom, doesn't it? Well, after negotiations, we gained access to the top floor of the warehouse and spent a very, very sweaty morning and afternoon pulling away from the wall a vast quantity of life preservers. Life preservers. And in so doing, we unearthed row upon row of untouched Edison cylinders in numerical order, six to the box. Sarah Bernhardt, Sophie Tucker, Leo Szlezak, you name them. Though he was very wary at the time, I insisted on our loading Caden's automobile to the roof. But his attitude changed when back in New York, I sold a good number of the cylinders to Lorda Greenway. A few months later, I was invited to produce a radio program on vocal recordings over station WQXR then W2XR, which is presently also celebrating its 50th anniversary. By that time, I had written some historical material for P.G. Hearst, which he incorporated into his column into the gramophone. I now became known to many European dealers and collectors. Nevertheless, when Bauer's first book came out in 1937, he told a friend that he had never heard of me or my work, though by some coincidence, the same typographical errors that had appeared in my book now appeared in his. One or perhaps 2 years later, I even made a brief venture into the world of jazz recordings. A friend introduced me to Alfred Lyons, who had just recorded, but not yet put out, the first releases on the Blue Note label. I believe they were of Mead Lux Lewis and Albert Ammons. I invested a small sum in this undertaking, but was much too foolish to continue in this vein. Likewise, I was equally foolish, or perhaps too cautious, to invest in a small number of Mapleson cylinders that were offered me in Brooklyn. However, I did buy heavily from such sources as Benny Mono. Benny who, you say? Well, Benny Mono was a barber. Not exactly a good barber. But in the back room of his shop, away from the steam towels, he maintained a huge stock of phonotopia and phonotype records. He even put out his own catalogs, which I still own. And yes, I did obtain from him nearly complete sets of Fernando De Lucia's Barber of Seville and Rigoletto. In 1939, after a little scouting around, my father located a small store at the corner of 53rd Street and 6th Avenue with a rental of $40 a month. And with a slight change of name to American Record Collectors Exchange, we were in the retail business. When a year or two later, a much larger store became available around the corner, we moved to what is now the main entrance of the Hilton Hotel. Theoretically, this was a good area for a shop carrying recordings of classical music. Yet, unfortunately, 6th Avenue was not then the busiest of streets. In fact, it wasn't even yet the Avenue of the Americas. Although some of you may remember that store with its vast stock room in the back where I was able to show off those bulky Victor and Columbia album sets in numerical sequence, virtually complete from M1 on. All this while, I was indulging my particular hobby of collecting catalogs, periodicals, and the like. I was able to buy out the collection of the International Records Agency with its especially rich supply of monthly supplements and numerical listings. As you know, many recorded items never appeared in regular catalogs. This was especially true of the 1930s, when the worldwide depression affected the record business so drastically. From abroad, I was able to obtain a run of Talking Machine News and similar research material. Thus it was that I continued revision and enlargement of my guide. By the mid-1940s, I had completed the long numerical listings of Victor Red Seals and other celebrity labels. As was obvious from the very beginning, only a numerical approach could ensure a reasonable degree of completeness and accuracy. My book was now over five times larger than the previous one, and I sought to find a publisher. This I did, but I waited and waited for the actual publication. And after a great passage of time, I decided to extricate myself from the contract and to publish my own collector's guide to American recordings. The typesetting was done in Pennsylvania by a wonderful craftsman working from my handwritten manuscript. You can well imagine how sets of numbers and foreign titles can go awry in transcript. Yet nothing went wrong in almost 8,000 listings. I was very pleased. I was also very pleased and thrilled by the universal praise that my book received. But the project depleted almost all of my cash reserve. Luckily, an event had occurred in the spring of 1946 which altered the locale of my activities. Jack Caden, of whom I spoke earlier, had his now established record store on 7th Avenue, also near 53rd Street. But he was about to enter manufacturing. You see, gloves were truly a matter of the past for him. And he sold me the store, which we then stocked and named the Classical Record Shop. Even more luckily, Christopher Bruno came into our business to take over the management of this second store. I can truthfully say that without him, I would soon have had no business at all. It was he who took over the reins when I fell ill with a very severe case of rheumatoid arthritis, which crippled me physically for over 7 years, beginning in 1950, and returns sporadically to this day, and I mean this day. I'm afraid the weather predictions were only too accurate in the bulletins you got. Meanwhile, a controversial undertaking came about, once again from outside pressure or suggestions. I'm not that all imaginative on my own. My collector's guide was surprisingly getting a great deal of attention in national press and periodicals, such as the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, Life magazine, and so forth. I received thousands of requests asking that I set down some evaluations of the approximately 8,000 records I had documented. This I did in the Price Guide to Collectors Records, to the best of my ability, as I pointed out in my preface. And I must say that this book, now 34 years later, is in its third edition and still selling quite well. Meanwhile, our classical record shop had already gone over completely to long play records. In this highly competitive and a little more than devious market, it was no easy task to succeed. One great boost we received was the introduction of RCA Camden Records and the Columbia Entree series. We immediately identified, for example, the correct sources of the Sutton and Warwick and Centennial orchestras, and featured this information along with other items in these series, prominently in our shop display window. We campaigned vigorously to convince and educate buyers to the great value to be found in the classical performances on these labels. Our small store soon became the largest dealer in New York City of these still wonderful items. Another means of securing some clientele for ourselves was to carry a full range of current and especially out-of-print classical discs, even some of a very doubtful origin. It was in our store, for instance, that Regina Resnick, listening to the Allegro sets of the complete Ring des Nibelungen, decided it was her own voice she was listening to and rushed out to sue the company. Perhaps there are some in this auditorium who do not know that there was a time when one could actually listen to records in some stores before deciding whether or not to purchase, not necessarily to bring suit. While our business was now entirely in LPs, My personal desire was to extend my research to the end of the 78 era. I had collected much of the research material I needed and even planned to indicate which 78s were to be found on the various grooves of LP repressings. All this was and has been very hard work. And fortunately, further archival investigation was made possible in 1979 by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Unfortunately, 1 year was not enough to complete what I had hoped to accomplish. Were there more time, I would like to spin out more true tales for you, like the trial over the color red, which is not a movie plot. Yes, Victor sued Columbia circa 1941, when the latter company issued popular records made with a red label. I was engaged to prove that Columbia had used the color red first, actually in 1903. My recollection is that the whole thing was thrown out of court, but not, of course, before lawyers made millions. Now, I have never heard of millions or even thousands being spent by either company on historical research into their recordings. For one, I would like to continue my research. I would also like to sell the vast collection of catalogs, supplements, and periodicals I amassed over the past 55 years, and on some of which I still pay rent for storage. And were there more time, I would like to expand on some of the vignettes that come to mind regarding the recordings and their recorders. For instance, Misha Elman, who was querulous about the prices his out-of-print sets were fetching. "Look," he said, I made them, and I know they're not worth that exorbitant amount." Or of Tito Skipa, who denied he made certain recordings until they were actually shown to him. Of Countess Lily McCormick and Mrs. Dorothy Caruso, who were delighted at the way collectors were seeking out the rarer records of their respective husbands. Of Mr. Horowitz, standing in the corner like a wooden Indian, listening to Battistini's voice and singing, while his wife broke down and cried every time we put on a record of Aureliano Pertile. And of her brother, Walter Toscanini, bringing us goodies from his father's archives. Of Jussi Björling, who objected every time he passed the store and one of his albums was not on display in the window. And finally, the universally admired Giuseppe De Luca, who was kind enough to lend his name to the preface of my book. But I have promised to allow some time for questions from the audience, and we have 5-10 minutes left, so ask me anything you would like.
Why did you not continue with the electrical aspect of the radar?
Okay.
Get me another grant and I will. It takes time, it takes study. If you want to do it thoroughly, you just can't do it off the top of your head. You have to look and relook and then go back and make sure there was no mistake. Any other question? Terry?
Apart from the Mendelssohn cylinder, what is the one thing that you passed up that you could have bought that you most regret?
A whole collection of original cartoons, if you can call them such, by Enrico Caruso.
I don't think you
Much some of that material I did buy. A quite famous thing in her day, Eleanor Broadfoot, on records and later in her career known as Eleanor de Cisneros, died in poverty, I think, at the Taft Hotel around 1934, I should imagine. I'm not too sure of the date, and I was able to buy some very interesting things from that auction. But I've passed up a lot of things. I was always hampered by the lack of ready cash, and more importantly, by the lack of, how they say, capital impetus. I am not, I'm not a chance taker. Look, I mean, I was offered a building around the corner for $18,000 and said, oh, I can't afford it, and it later sold for $600,000. So that's another thing, Terry, that I regret. Any other question? Yes.
Talking of money, how is it the Gili family had fared so badly? Both the mother was evicted, now the daughter's been evicted.
Who?
Gili. Where did all the money go?
Gili?
Yeah.
Was evicted? I don't understand you.
He died. His wife then was evicted from her property. More recently, his daughter was evicted and is now in the poorhouse. Where did all the Gili millions go?
I don't know where my own money went for the most part. If I may, I'll say just one thing. Since you brought up the name of Beniamino Gili, I'm asked often about him. I will tell you this, he had the best controlled voice I have ever heard. He could take a tone, swell it, diminish it, had the sweetness of tone, and his like is not around anymore. Thank you very much.